This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My two featured guests tonight are Diana O'Hare and Terry Arrett. Now, from time to time, I record programs outside of the studio. This is the case with Diana O'Hare. I recorded the program in her home in San Francisco, and you'll hear a little air conditioning going on. But that's okay, we get to hear O'Hare. So I'm going to play that interview first. She's going to read from her latest collection of poems, Walk Me to Schenectady. Sandra Gilbert says, Walk Me to Schenectady is an extraordinary sequence of what have lately been called anti-elegies, vivid personal poems of mourning that refuse the conventionally consolatory closure of the traditional elegy. Private as they may seem, these are brilliantly artful public poems in the mode of the Letters to the Dead, produced by such artists as Donald Hall and Ted Hughes, but with at times an almost surreally comic turn. These poignant shapes of grief will bring ironic twists of recognition, along with indrawn breaths of pain, to all who have mourned or know that they will inevitably mourn. Let's go now to my interview with Diana O'Hare. This segment of Word Temple is coming to you from the San Francisco home of Diana O'Hare, and I'm going to spell her last name. It's O'Hehir. She is the author of fiction as well as poetry. She's written 5 novels and 5 poetry collections. Busy woman. One novel, I Wish the War Were Over, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. She has received many awards for her poetry, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Poetry Society of America's De Castagnola Award, among others. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I am very thrilled to be here.
Well, it's so good to meet you. You know, because the vast majority of bookstores these days limit their poetry books to about a dozen or fewer authors on, you know, 2 or less bookshelves, it's not easy to discover new poets. And by new, I mean maybe anyone published after Pablo Neruda. But there's a used bookstore in Santa Rosa called Treehorn. And I was mousing around in there one day, and I just came across your book, Home Free. And it grabbed me right away.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so glad.
Oh, I went home, and I have this table where I put all of the books that are mailed to me or books that I'm interested in. And I put Home Free on a very special spot that lets me know I need to find this poet. And, you know, so I was hoping that I'd be able to find you, that you were indeed in California, still around.
And here I am, and delighted to have been found.
Yeah, well, you know, astonishingly, before I could even start looking to see if you were still in Northern California, I received an email, I think from Dan Bellum, letting me know that you have a new book of poems. And it was just amazing. The timing was really something else. So that new book is Walk Me to Schenectady. So thank you, Dan Bellum.
I'll thank Dan Bellum, too. He's wonderful.
Absolutely. Well, Home Free and Walk Me to Schenectady are equally moving, and I'm not using that word lightly. Home Free focuses in one large part on your late parents.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm.
And Walk Me to Schenectady on your late husband. Having said this, I need to point out that these poems are not what one might expect from a lot of contemporary poetry books. Your poems rise way above anything that could be called prose. And they're private, and yet they make the reader relate very, very deeply to the emotions in those poems.
Thank you. That's good.
That is exactly why I had to find you. These losses are your own, but because of your skill and your heart, they reflect ours as well, whether we've gone through those losses yet or will someday.
I think that everybody has some loss in their life, and therefore they're able to relate to some extent to poems about loss.
Absolutely. Well, I want to turn to the poems in just a minute, but First, can we talk about you for a little bit?
Yes, absolutely.
Where are you from? Where did you grow up? You're in your 80s now, right?
Yes,
Yeah, where did
you
grow up?
Actually, literally, I am in my 90s. I just had my 90th birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
It was a terrible blow. I didn't think that was ever going to happen, and it happened.
It happened.
And I survived, and it was perfectly all right, finally, at the other end.
Yeah, well, good, good.
I grew up in Berkeley. And that would imply that I haven't wandered far, but actually I did. I grew up in Berkeley and left when I was 18. And I went to the East Coast, and my degrees are mostly from Johns Hopkins University.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. It is a very good university, and people think of it primarily in relation to medicine, but it has a good humanities department. And at the time that I had anything to do with it, a very exclusive humanities department where they hardly ever took women. And I do not know why they took me. It was a fluke of some kind. Many places are geared as to whether or not they like you. They like something about you when you come in and ask for admission. And I honestly think it was that rather than any virtues I had.
So what years were you there?
Oh, good God, I've forgotten. I was there during the early 50s.
Okay.
And then I got a PhD finally in the 60s.
Excellent. Well, you taught English and creative writing at Mills College in Oakland for a number of years. When were you there?
I taught at Mills for 32 years.
Wow.
So I left in the early 1990s, and I had come in the 60s again.
Yeah. Good. Well, what a time to come back to the Berkeley area in the 60s.
Yes, it was.
A lot going on.
It was. It was a marvelous time. And it was funny. My first year at Mills, I entered the classroom, and all of the students stood up. And it scared me to pieces.
Wow.
And I said to them, you don't need to do this. Please don't. And within a year, the entire climate of the campus had changed. And they were going out on strike about this and that and organizing marches. And it was just amazing.
It moved from a much more formal atmosphere to a more
formal
free.
And ladylike, yes. Uh-huh. And suddenly it was informal and combative and
wonderful.
Yes, and exciting.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Well, let's move to Home Free, which that's the book I first found by you. It's not your first book, I don't believe.
No, it isn't.
But it's the book I found in Treehorn. It was published in 1988. And would you just go ahead and read maybe four poems from Home Free?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to.
And then we'll move on to your newest book.
I will say that of the two books, it's impossible to have two books by yourself and not to compare them. Mm-hmm. And any artist always likes the most recent work the best, and I do. I like my most recent book best. I think it's more straightforward and simpler and more direct and more honest and more all that kind of stuff
than
Home Free is.
Well, they're new to me. The poems in Home Free are new to me. So,
well, as I went back over them, I found myself picking out some that I really liked and some that I was fairly critical of. I tend to use metaphor a lot, and I use it almost too much in this series of poems, to the extent that some readers, I think, found that a barrier and they were unable to get past the metaphor. But here is one that I think communicates very clearly without necessity to metaphor. It's called Infant. The head tilts back like a heavy leaf. The eyes so shut with a row of grains. The hand wavers under the chin, fingers splayed. This is exactly the way I remember it, no syllable different. Navy blue boiled eyes and cuckoo mouth, cuckoo child. All of us always have known. Recognition printed on the cells of the primitive body chart. Every night that month, I dreamed the baby was born. It was fragile, creased like an overseas envelope. It was mislaid. I had forgotten to feed it. I woke up, moved my awkward belly into the bathroom, stood gasping at the edge of the wash basin. I would never be used to this. And when I picked up the real baby, it settled its heavy weight between my arm and my body like a sullen beanbag. Pushed its face against me, pulled me into it. That dream about having had the baby and forgotten to feed it, incidentally, is apparently a very common dream. All kinds of women have come to me and said that they had had it when they were pregnant.
That fear of not being capable of taking care of this
yes,
new life.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's
exactly.
Huge.
Yeah.
You have a poem in Home Free called I Search for My Mother Who Died When I Was 4, and I'm assuming that this is a kind of a true story poem.
Exactly, yes, it
did
is.
Did she die in a car accident?
She died in an automobile accident, and I was sitting on her lap.
Yeah.
So this is indeed a traumatic event, which I think I remember. It's a little hard to be certain with memories that one knows people have talked about since. Mm-hmm. It's a little hard to be certain that you're really remembering them or you're remembering a story that you constructed in response to the things people said. But I think I do remember
it. Yeah, I mean, it's such an enormous...
Yes, it was.
Life-changing
an enormous
incident.
Event,
that
certainly.
I think it would be hard for you not to remember
yeah.
it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you read
Surely.
I Search for My Mother Who
Surely.
Died When I Was 4?
Every morning at 2 o'clock, I lean forward, I go in feet first, I let it swallow me. Into the catacomb of Knossos, through the tunnel that frets the world, through the deep aorta of the world's machine, the open silent valve, its webbed fingers gray. And there at the center you are, your hair fanned around you, your fingers spread on your shoulder. In that heart of nothing, my own heart stops. Aren't you ever coming back? Can't you tell me any of your secrets? But accident is a net of fabric around you. You're a magnet for silence. It makes beads for the mesh of your coverlet. Memory's hair is black. The face of memory is carved from stone. Nothing is memory's hallmark.
You have another poem called Your Face, and I think this is the one that really let me know what happened in that accident. It's on page 42.
Your face for my mother. The windshield of our car cracked in a spray. Glass sprinkled the pavement. Blood stained the face of my doll, filled one of her round cloth ears. You went away. I was entirely broken. And I can't ever stop looking for you there. With that ache in the weak left lung, the jawline, or the end of a long corridor where I wait for you. 4 years old, in a white nightgown, calling out help or a glass of water. But when I see you there, it's not what I wanted to see. You're leaning on the upright seat of our car with me on your lap, your arm tight around me. But you are entirely changed, your eyes cracked across, your face shattered.
Thank you. So I know you're going to read the title poem of the book.
I am.
You go ahead and read that and any other poem you
yeah.
want, and then we'll move on to Walk Me to Schenectady.
The title of the book is Home Free, and so is the title of this poem. And it finishes with an incident which I actually saw in Bangkok. Inch by inch along the bed, growing more compact, his arms pulled up like bird's wings. My father is almost 90. I love you, I say over and over, until I read in Time magazine that saying this holds the dying back. They get polite, they hang around to thank you. I love you, I say, under my breath. In Bangkok, you can buy a bird in front of the temple for 20 cents. It's not to eat, nor to listen to, nor to admire, but to set free. Spring the door with your plastic diner's card. Wait for the scrabble, the head poked out the door, air by your face, and up he goes.
That's really beautiful, and it's such a true statement in there that you've made about the dying letting go and how we need to let them go so they can go.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've experienced that also.
That was repeated to me again when my husband was dying.
Uh-huh.
I found it very hard to let go, but...
I think we all
yes,
do.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, would you like to read anything more from Home Free, or do you want to move on to...
Let's move on to okay. Walk Me to Schenectady.
All right. So Walk Me to Schenectady was published in letterpress by the Aryan Press in San Francisco's Presidio.
Yes.
It feels like kind of an historic book that it's coming out of the Presidio and that it's letterpress. It's a beautiful book.
It is pretty. It is. I delight in the... pages and the print, very heavy pages and very nice print.
And tell me about the picture on the cover.
The picture on the cover is not of anybody I know. It was taken by a fellow resident here at the Carlisle, which is where I live, an apartment building for older people. And this, the photographer, whose name is Fiz, P-H-I-Z, she named herself after the illustrator for Dickens. She's a wonderful photographer. She's won all kinds of prizes. And this is a photograph of a very happy couple of, say, 25 or 30 years ago, walking through a California scene. Mm-hmm. And obviously, they either have just been married or are on their way to become married. It's and that's all I know.
Yeah, well, it's such a fitting picture, and it is kind of 60s California
yes,
feeling.
Yes, very definitely. Yeah.
Well, Sandra Gilbert has written that these new poems are notable for the deceptively simple, apparently naive nakedness with which they grieve the death of your husband of many years, Mel Fiske. She calls the book a sequence that has been called anti-elegies, and it's easy to concur here. Before reading any poems from the book, let's talk for a minute about your husband, Mel Fiske. He died in 2008, and he was a very active man politically, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah.
He was a journalist, a labor organizer, and an activist. And from what I hear, he was a real constant presence for anti-Iraq war rallies.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's known for that. And he once worked for the lawyers of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg?
He did.
What did he do for them?
I do not know. We were separated at the time, and he did volunteer work of some sort, but I don't know what.
And you were married to each other not once, but twice.
We were.
Yeah,
we
so
were.
With a space of 36 years
That's
in between.
32 years.
32
yeah.
years.
Yes.
What happened? This is a good story.
Yes, it is a good story, and I have written it up, and I will someday get it published, I think. What broke us up was McCarthy, and we had a small, like 8 months, 9 months old baby, and I began to feel very trapped, very tied down by this baby, very responsible because of the baby, and very scared. It was more and more as McCarthy entered the lives of the people we knew. And Mel was very active. He was visibly active in all kinds of left-wing enterprises. And I finally said to him, I can't take this, not with the baby. I'm sorry. I'm terribly sorry. And I actually have a poem in the book in which we're sitting in the playground of our housing project, and I tell him this. And I left. I was sorry at the time. I was sorry afterwards. But I did comfort myself, sort of, by going back to college. That was when I went back to Johns Hopkins and got accepted as a graduate student and became a graduate student in creative writing. And I then married another fellow student. And Mel, of course, had, being an extremely handsome, outgoing, loving man.
He was very handsome.
Oh, just really great, really good looking. He married somebody else, and I married somebody else, and he had two children, and I had one, and we did not see each other for 32 years.
Wow.
Until he had separated from his interim wife, and I had separated from my interim husband, and I wrote a book which was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. And he wrote me a very sweet letter in which he said, "What a great book, and I'm so proud of you." And I thought, boy, what a nice thing for an ex-husband. So I wrote, and he wrote, and I wrote, and he wrote. And he said, "You have to sign a book for me." And I said, "Why, of course." And he sent the book, and I signed it. And then he sent me a note and said, "I owe you a beer." And I said, "No, you don't. You owe me a dinner." And he was in Los Angeles and I was in Berkeley. So he came up to Berkeley to supply the dinner. And it normally takes 5 hours to drive from Los Angeles to Berkeley. Mm-hmm. It took him 2 days. He said at every inroad along the way, he pulled in and said, "What am I doing? Am I crazy?"
"It's just dinner, Mel."
He said to himself, "How is this going to end?" And it wasn't just dinner. We had dinner, and it turned out to be much more than dinner. I think both of us knew almost immediately that we could get back together again, that we wanted to.
That's incredible.
Yes.
And so you were married for how many more years after that?
20 or 22.
That's just an amazing story. You do have to write that book. I look forward to reading it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to start by asking you to read just a number of poems from Walk Me to Schenectady, but if you would you start with a prologue of the book?
And oh, then, really?
Sure.
It's rather long. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah.
It's quite funny, and it's quite quite interesting, but it is rather long. All right, let's see what happens. Prologue. "I have a what, I say? I have done what to my what? Pelvis, darling, the nurse tells me. You have fractured your pelvis. The nurse is a handsome Puerto Rican man of about 30. You have fractured your pelvis, babe." I sum it up a picture to go with the word pelvis. A Halloween skeleton, the cross piece that traverses him at the base of the backbone and unites the tops of his legs, is his pelvis. That straight hunk that makes everything stay together. I can't have broken it. That's absolutely impossible. "Here, baby," says the nurse, "I got this pill here. You want water to go with it? Or Coke, maybe? Where am I?" "Tunnels End Hospital. Water, I guess. Ready. Here goes." I am in the middle bed of a room for three people. Pink curtains encircle my bed. I accept the water and the pill, which I am told is Percocet. "It'll stop the hurting," the nurse says. So far, there is no hurting. I'm more aware of the noise out in the hall than I am of any pain. I have just spent the night in Kaiser Hospital, where they took way too many x-rays, and now an ambulance ride has deposited me in this place. "Lie back and it'll stop hurting," the nurse says. "It doesn't," I tell him. But obediently, I lie back, and when I wake up, it does indeed hurt like hell. It has become evening, and more lights are on. My roommate on the right rests on the mattress, bare to the gaze, uncovered by any sheet. She seems to be made mostly of plaster. Plaster around her left leg, her torso, and her right arm. She is singing Frankie and Johnny in an insecure contralto, and has just arrived at the line about "True as the stars above." I ring the bell and ask for another pill. "Of course, babe," the nurse says. "You got a bad break." Later on, I am told that a pelvic fracture is the most painful you can have. But I don't really believe it. There doesn't seem to be that much pain. But maybe the impression is a tribute to Percocet, the habit-forming pill that I have been started on. Percocet not only dampens pain, but it also makes you write poetry. I am not the only person who has noticed this. Vivian, who was in Tunnel's End before me, agrees. And Sonia, who is here now, sort of agrees. Not exactly poetry, she says, more music. Not music at all, I tell her. I am not musical, but I am poetic, and so I write poetry. My friend Sonia is too old to tell me whatever, which is what the nurses are saying to each other. But the idea communicates. It makes you creative, she says. It was and it did. I wrote over 25 poems while I was at Tunnel's End. Some of them are fairly good. I am grateful for them because the principal subject is my husband, Mel, who had been dead more than a year and a half and about whom I had not been able to write one single word. Mel would have been very sympathetic about my broken pelvis had he been here to share it. And I invoked him a lot while I lay in Tunnel's End eating habit-forming opiates. I was very glad to be able to evoke him. "You sure do write a lot," the nurse told me. "I guess it helps you feel better. You're a real good patient." I agreed that I was a good patient. I was also a good poet. It sort of went together.
That's wonderful. Thank you. I think that's a great introduction to this book.
Well, I hope it doesn't convert too many people to Percocet.
I know.
I worried about that a little bit.
Yeah, take Percocet and write good poetry.
I think maybe I'll read the title poem first because people do ask me why it's called Walk Me to Schenectady, and there is a specific, pretty clear reason. I miss my pal. My Irish auntie said this after my Irish uncle died. They had that kind of a relationship. Pal, an ancient Irish word, I recognized it right away. Of course, it isn't an ancient Irish word. I'm just saying that. Like, hold my hand. Tell me something silly. Stay up all night with me tonight. Walk me to Schenectady. I've never been there. Now we come to the lonely part. Oh, I knew what she meant, all right. And later, it got more so. And maybe I'll read the first poem in the book, 30 Years. You said, I thought of you every day we were apart. And we were apart 30 years. I laughed and told you that was impossible. I tried to pull your hair, which was white and clipped short. Your son and I discussed this at your deathbed over your prostrate body. You were quiet, being full of morphine. And once again I said, impossible, not every day, not for 30 years, which woke you out of your coma. You struggled up and tried to say yes. Propped on one wobbly arm on the too small rented hospital bed. Yes. While I moved toward you, just beginning to understand how 30 years is not that long, not compared with always.
How old was he when he died?
He was almost 90.
Wow.
89.
Wow.
Yeah. I think I thought he was going to live forever. I didn't see any reason why he shouldn't.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have any other poems in the book that you would like me particularly to read?
I would love to hear Breath.
All right.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Diana O'Hare reading from Walk Me to Schenectady.
breath, my husband went away and never came back. Two exhalations down near the bottom of the bed. I knew better, but looked for him just like real people do. Not in dreams or sealed closets or dark corners, maybe in a double dose of Percocet, maybe in prayer, which is totally useless, or in meditation. That stuff will knock you sideways. It was my fault. I didn't hold on tight enough. He breathed out and wasn't there in just two breaths, so slight they went right through my fingers. I think I'll read Why Can't I Dream About Him, which was an experience I had for about a year and a half, and then I did, as you will see. Why can't I dream about him? 17 months and still not back. He must be having a tough trip. A friend said it's a short drive. I know better. It's hard days, harsh nights. He'll be here if I just give him time. Someone saw him in Santa Barbara. I know better. He's over the border. Someone glimpsed him at the Picasso show. Send me directions, I said. I'll go there, too. A letter told me he's surely forgotten. I tore that up into tiny scraps. A friend said I should face facts. I said, no. Facts don't count when you're waiting. I'm not worried, I told them all. I know there are people, some people, just a few. Come rain or sleet or flood or snow, that always follow through, that simply don't know how to let a girl down. He'll be here soon.
You have a poem that it addresses him, but it also addresses an eye condition that you have, and the poem is called Shadow.
Shadow. I woke up one morning and couldn't see. It didn't last long. A black card clapped over one eye. I knew right away it's what I got for losing you. Not holding on tight enough, letting you go. That time when the nice doctor frowned down on his pile of papers and said, well, yes, there's a shadow. Looking down, looking troubled, said, maybe not chemo. Maybe chemo and radiation both. And you said, no, neither one. I don't want to go out like that. And I agreed, sure, yes, whatever you say, darling. When I should have, what do they say? Fought? That's it, fought. It was all my fault. I let you go easy, as if I had another one someplace.
So did you actually, I mean, this poem makes me think that you went through major guilt at that time.
Oh, I did. More or less afterwards, I think, not during the time that he was ill, but afterwards.
And that's been resolved, I hope,
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And also, I have been told that it's standard that everybody who loses a mate manages to feel guilty one way or another. There's always something you didn't do. Right. Something that was inadequate. Pain pills. I eat them just the way you did, though you were dying and I am not. I hold the bottle close. Here's his bottle, only half empty. Here's a pill that he himself bit in half. Now in 20 minutes I won't remember any of it. I'll be in la-la land. Then along they come with their remedial measures. Those mean bastards cleaned that drug up. It doesn't work anymore. They took the menace out. My doctor says I just got drug resistant. A lot, he knows. You don't adjust to things that fast.
Why don't we close with the last two poems of the book, Tan Suitcase and Good Man Blues.
Okay. Tan Suitcase. I'm leaving you now, you said. I said no. You said you're ready to manage on your own now. I told you no. But you repeated, I'm leaving you, speaking to the wall or the floor, and went on packing your suitcase, a tan cardboard one with three-color stripe, the old-fashioned kind that could take you to Oakland or Ireland. I had a whole lot of things lined up to say. I wouldn't get to say them. You were smoothing down your packing, making those short, definite motions that broadcast, so long, sleep well, this is it. Good man blues. How we once did it over. This is a blues rhythm poem, and you'll recognize the rhythm. It's the St. James Infirmary and a whole lot of others. Yeah. That good man came back one night, opened my unlocked door one night, said, let's do it over, do it right. He parked his car at my door, parked his old white car at my door, brought in his box of books, dropped his shoes down on my floor. I said, last time I left you, got up one morning and left you. He said, okay, and lay down on my pillow, rested his hands at my waist, his sturdy hands at my waist. I said, those are the hands I still love best. Stretched out his big body, his handsome, shiny body. I said, I've wanted that weekdays and Sundays. Darling, I said, I'm scared I'll hurt you, afraid I'll really hurt you. He said, okay, and pulled me down toward the pillow. I lay down on top of him, spread myself out over him. It was like my best remembering. He had dark hair and mine was red. He dark curly hair, mine was red. We laughed about those fragments in the bed. I was 18, he 24. 18 years old, he 6 years more. So young, so raw, so fierce, so cockeyed, sure. We rocked the bed. The landlady banged on the door.
That's just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Oh, my gosh. You know, before we leave, I want to ask, are you writing poetry now or fiction or both?
I am writing some poetry now, and I have a memoir about the years that occurred between the time that we separated and the time we got together.
Wonderful. So. And you taught creative writing for so many years. What message would you give young writers today?
I don't know. My major message is just keep on, keep on, keep on.
Yeah.
Or in other words, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Yeah.
Practice, practice, practice. really, do not be discouraged. Continue. Even if you think you're out of vogue or the things you write are not right, if you are driven, if you are compelled, it will turn out to be right.
Excellent. Thank you so much for doing this today. It was just wonderful.
Thank you for asking me.
This is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to Diana O'Hare reading from her fifth collection of poems, Walk Me to Schenectady. Up next, former Poet Laureate of Sonoma County, Terry Arrett, reads from her latest collection, Night Sky Journey. Forrest Hamer says that Terry Arrett's moving collection of poems traces the emergence of poems and of the self from the unconscious, dream, and memory, locating each creation in a variety of compelling landscapes and experiences. Here now is Terry Arrett reading from Night Sky Journey.
About a month ago, I spent 3 days at Tassajara, which is a Zen Buddhist retreat center in the mountains of Big Sur. And just by coincidence, the person who had stayed in the cabin before me left behind a book called When Things Fall Apart, Heart Advice for Difficult Times by Pema Chodron. The premise of the book is that we can learn strategies, lessons in a Buddhist way, for sitting with chaos, which, as it turns out, is the natural condition of our lives. And although the Buddhists are fond of saying that chaos is very good news, it is also a difficult companion. I went to my new collection, Night Sky Journey, thinking of which poems to read, and it occurred to me that poem after poem in that book had to do with this hard task of sitting with chaos. The first poem with which the book opens is called To Find the Way Out. To find the way out, pull everything apart, lost and solitary. You, the once strong emperors of creation, who wrote the first words in the dialect of snow, lodged inside the stones you once carved, inside the smallest sounds ringing in the great ear of creation, you sing. Though we now, in our labyrinths of streets and avenues, time and grief, hear it only as the cry of what we lost once long ago in a dream. That poem was a kind of imaginative mistranslation of a poem by the great Mexican poet Octavio Paz. And in fact, it's a quote from Octavio Paz that is the epigraph for the book, Deserve Your Dream. I was thinking about the different ways that through our lives we come up against chaos and what helps us get through it. And one of those things is the way families invent stories about what's going on in our lives, not necessarily related to what's actually happening in our lives, but these stories. And they get recorded in home movies, a strange genre, but nonetheless, one with directors and scripts and an intended audience. I spent an afternoon watching the home movies of my husband and his family in his childhood, and it reminded me so much of my own. And later I wrote this poem, Home Movies. If there were one moment to freeze, let it be the dance on the patio in the backyard, all of us in a line, stepping to the left, the right, now lifting our legs and turning, hands clapping, and all of this in synchronized silence. The silence memory imposes so you can see your life purely, without the complication of having lived it. There are moments like this that seem so orderly. No one can hear the director off screen shouting instructions. No one knows that ahead of you lie the great falls, the strangers, the terrible joys you'll nearly die from, their dark hands shaking your heart. Behind you, nothing but packing and unpacking and all the uncertainty of your parents slamming against each other in their fear of loving too much or too little. Right now, this one scene might as well be your life, sweet, organic. Memory has caught us, dancing in the backyard, all of us stepping and turning together, just like a family. When I was a child, like many writers, I was very lonely, and one of the antidotes for that loneliness was to pick up the telephone and dial popcorn. In 2007, AT&T ended this service. I wonder now what people do when they have those lonely moments. At any rate, the article in the Chronicle announcing this was called The End of Time is Near, and I stole that for this prose poem. The end of time is near for Mary Moore, Jane Barbie, and Joanne Daniels. Voices of Time, 1950 to 2007. Even when you were so far out of any loop that no friends would call, and you had no friends to call up, you could always dial popcorn. And there, on the other end of the mysterious wires that connect people, was her voice announcing, "The time is now 10:39:30. A moment of silence, and again her voice calmly reassuring, "The time is now 10:39:40. You could stay on the line as long as you wanted, and it felt almost like being liked enough to get a phone call or to give one. Sometimes on a lonely Saturday afternoon, I'd place my finger in the metal holes of the dial as it rotated round and back on its stem like some alien flower, till out of the quiet emptiness bloomed the voice of the Time Lady. And I thought of her as a real woman, not a recorded voice, but a grown-up who woke every day, went to a phone booth somewhere in the Midwest, and waited for the calls to come. She'd pull out her clocks, set to the different time zones, and arrange them on the metal ledge inside the booth. Somehow she'd know when the call came in just what part of the country you were from. No need for hellos, no need for chit-chat. She had a job to do. Yours was to listen, hers to ask no questions, but to go on shaving the edge off eternity in 10-second increments." Later on, when I was in high school, I discovered poetry. My guide into the world of poetry was the Latin poet Virgil, a good escort, since, of course, he was also Dante's escort through the layers of purgatory and hell, left him at the gates of paradise. One of the techniques that Virgil used that I loved so much is something called chiasmus. It's a technical name for a particular kind of poetic device where opposites are linked through a poetic cross balance. Chiasmus. I pull one morning out from the many that were my life in 1973. On this one, I'm running down the hill below my house on my way to Latin. Nothing is happening to me to mark this day, but I'm singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning," and "When I was 17, it was a very good year," and it is. The colleges have all said yes, and the mailman has been delivering love letters all spring, and the delicate balance of Virgil's chiasmus so pleases me, it's magna cum murmure montis. This is the year my brother is in jail. Same year the CIA assassinates the president of Chile. Same year the crooks in Washington are voted back into office and get even crookeder. I couldn't know how close to the edge I was, how hard the fall might be. It was a bright spring morning, and my whole life was about to happen, and the shortcut through the sleeping grass and clover wild above the streets of my town would deliver me momently into the mysterious cross-balance of murmuring mountains, Helen and Dido, arms and the man. One of the other pleasures in life that has served me well in times of chaos, mainly to do the Buddhist thing, quite unconsciously, of running toward the chaos rather than away from it. I love to travel. And I like to have as little agenda as possible so that the day is uncharted. This was one of those days. Pleasures of the door. A door offers itself to the possibility of pleasure. In Paris, you and I walked out each morning to see the fine paintings and the wide avenues, but stopped again and again in front of great, broad wooden doors, each a different question, each with its round brass handle that held our reflections, miniatures in a small metallic world that had always belonged to this door on the Rue Montorgueil. We stood before ourselves like Van Eyck's married couple, as though, like them, we might go on living in the brass sphere of the handle long after we had walked on down the street and turned a corner and disappeared into the rest of the day, a day in which the light came drifting, pouring from the stones, from the blossoming trees, from the air. The title poem for the collection is Night Sky Journey. It's a series of 8 sonnets, unrhymed, and they were all written during a time period when I was traveling in the Southwest, mostly southern Utah and western Colorado, Mesa Verde area. And I was also simultaneously reading another great poet of the Spanish language, Pablo Neruda, from Chile. These poems were written under the influence of Neruda's words and music in Spanish, but they are not translations in any sense of the word. The opening poem is a look right into the heart of that chaos. Night Sky Journey. For me, the sky is no home, is a vast sea of sadness where once my heart fought and died, and lies not buried, but rocking in a boat anchored between 2 mountains. All night, the moon's sharp edges slice the heart in my breast. All night, I break into pieces again and again, waiting for daylight to gather me, waiting like one alone at a station, waiting for the train of memory to rumble up into daylight, into a morning threaded by trains, the bustle of each day's arrival. I turn and turn in this night of errors, fractured by the burning light of my heart, fractured by the wind that blows here in the vast country of sleep. No one knows what the wind illumines, what shapes form in the little anxieties that each hour follow behind us, ringing like bells. Another poem from that series came to me in an interesting way. Of course, I was in that strange landscape where once an ocean lay, now this desert-like with strange rock formations. And I was thinking about intimacy. I began writing the poem with my best friend in mind. She and I met when I was 3 and she was 5. And what we had was a kind of, I guess what psychologists would call a mirroring of each other. We looked so much alike, people took us for sisters. Somewhere along the way in the poem, the you morphs into a past lover, and finally into my husband. 2 birds. You and I were the same birds, the same words, the same agile gazelles, the same slender reeds. We were like 2 shells, 2 pearls cast upon the sand. The shadows fall all around me. My hands, once smooth, are creased. But look, in my dreams, we are once again light. More and more, my dreams shine like toys, though I am afraid of old sorrow that turns me to stone. My fears are bitter, dank. Was it you who made my young blood so agile, so guilty? Was it yesterday I held myself so guarded? Everything was filled with you. Everything was filled with you. Before you, I sat alone, thinking of problems, counting my worries. Everything robbed me except my sadness. Now I ask, what can I say to you? What can I promise? How can we again be two birds? How can we find again those two birds? We run to intimacy, a good place to go when the chaos threatens, as it does every day. It's the nature of our existence, after all. And I want to close with a poem about all the invisible things in this life that support us without our knowing it. Friends and our literary community. Sometimes people we don't even know. I was looking at a rock formation in Arches National Park. It's called Balance Rock, and you've probably seen it in car commercials. It's this rock impossibly posed on this very narrow column beneath. It looks like it's going to fall, but so far it hasn't. Balance Rock. As inevitable as what falls, it doesn't. Rests in vertical grace on its narrow neck, on its great tiered body of 10 million years, exposed by night and wind and the slow-breathing clouds. It stands above the red ochre rock because everything it once belonged to has vanished. Vast cathedrals of stone that once held the heavy head in place like the hands of a lover. How much of what supports us we never see. The sky pushing back against the river, the river lapping against the broken night, the night pressing against my eyelids, this burning that makes us sing.
This is Catherine Hastings. You just heard Terry Arrett read from her latest collection, Night Sky Journey. This was published by Kelly's Cove Press. We have a little time left, so here is Denise Levertov reading her poem, The Secret.
The Secret. Two girls discover the secret of life in a sudden line of poetry. I, who don't know the secret, wrote the line. They told me, through a third person, they had found it, but not what it was, not even what line it was. No doubt, by now, more than a week later, they have forgotten the secret, the line, the name of the poem. I love them for finding what I can't find, and for loving me for the line I wrote, and for forgetting it so that 1,000 times till death finds them, they may discover it again in other lines, in other happenings, and for wanting to know it, for assuming there is such a secret, yes, for that most of all.
And it's a wrap. Thanks very much to my featured guests tonight, Terry Arrett and Diana O'Hare. If you have any comments or questions, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. I'd love to hear from you. And be sure to check out wordtemple.com for the future live Word Temple Poetry Series events. Thanks for listening.